Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Fidel. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston, Texas, County, Monterey, Faraday, Santa Fe, Dallas, Glen Rock.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumbo Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumbo Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumbo Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Well, thank you very much, Audrey. Again, we could not do it without you. Mike, you can't do that. You can't offer me beef jerky right before the show starts. Come on, I need to talk. Mike wants wants us to have Jack Link's Chewy Jerky to be our sponsor. We're not one of the featured programs because we've chosen not to do that, so we won't have sponsors. But I think they do run ads beside our replays or something like that, but I don't want to get into the income business and who does. But anyway, ladies and gentlemen, what's that got to do with welcoming you? Welcome to the Blog Talk Radio Network and the Jumbo Justice Radio Show. I'm your host, Keith Haley, and we're approaching 4 years. Do you realize that? In November, just 2 months away, about a month and a half, actually, we'll be having done this. We will have done this about 4 years. Can you believe that? So wasted that amount of time. Actually, we have some people that listen to us across the state and across the Midwest and across the nation, and I think occasionally some Romanians listen to us overseas. But I'm your host, Keith Haley. We want to thank Johnny Cash for taking us on that trip again across the United States to 90-plus cities and states, and yes, he does sing that song from memory when he sang it live in concerts. Emily and Mike, thank you very much for being with us tonight, Emily, you did a little special work for us. I may comment on later this evening. But anyway, the purpose of this show is what it's always been. We try to discuss news, events, developments, and the always difficult and sometimes humorous practice of criminal justice. Some of these stories are meant to be serious, but when you actually look down upon them from another planet, they're kind of silly. I think I have a couple of those tonight about Detroit and Chicago. But anyway, our show is dedicated to these tireless, unending effort people that work in police, courts, corrections, and juvenile justice. And I meet some more and more virtually every week, and I'm amazed that they continue to do excellent work. And those that don't do excellent work often are either put out of the field or decide to leave, and that's probably a good idea. We try to look inside criminal justice and take a close-up look at its professionals and their practice. And we'll be seeing something tonight. I was going to ask Mike if chewing Jack Link's original shredded beef jerky is still legal. It's not a federal felony or not, but our show tonight has to do with the continuing, may I say continuous, expansion of federal laws, and many of them not requiring any type of criminal intent. And ladies and gentlemen, somewhere this has to stop. You're going to hear from some people tonight that it almost makes you cry to hear this couple. I'll tip you off. This guy was arrested for sending orchids in the mail and actually went to federal prison for 1 year. Couple, I'm guessing 55, 60 years old, maybe a little bit older than that. This guy did a year in prison for that. And I'll let John Stossel tell you that tonight. He'll be the commentator for the first 8 minutes of our show. But anyway, you're listening to the Blog Talk Radio show, and it's on the Blog Talk Radio Network. It's Jumbo Justice Radio Show. Al Levy is our CEO. I've got so much to do tonight, I'm hurrying. He's our CEO of the whole business, and he was the genius behind this thing. He started it 4 years ago. We joined him shortly after that. And now there are literally 30,000 plus shows. Who could even count them? Even President Obama has used Blog Talk Radio. And, of course, some of our most famous crime profilers, for example, Pat Brown, has now decided to have a Blog Talk Radio show. What is possible? Any person, that means you, any interest group, any organization, they can broadcast their own show and streaming audio over the Internet worldwide to an unlimited number of listeners. In other words, you could be Michael Savage, you could be whatever, because people can tune into your show live, and then better than that, it's even archived. They can replay that show and use it however they want. Some folks once in a while use our shows in criminal justice and criminology classes across the land. But anyway, get your own show. If you don't like this one, there's plenty to choose from on there, from laughter, yoga, on down to all sorts of other things. Tonight, our topic is going to be, again, the over-criminalization in terms of federal law. And we're going to start off with John Stossel talking about this particular case, several cases, actually. And then we're going to switch over to Heritage Foundation session that they had called Without Intent, How Congress is Eroding the Criminal Intent Requirement in Federal Law. And this continues to go. We did a show here 6 months ago, perhaps, on Harvey Silverglade's book called Three Felonies a Day. The idea behind that book was that you get up in the morning, you go do your work, you do your business, you go bowl after work or whatever, and you come home, you've probably committed 3 felonies. He's not kidding. He can show you with that. I mean, that's how broad and vague and unintending many of these federal laws are now, and there needs to be a stop to it. And I think if this administration is not going to do it, then the next one is going to have to do it. Just people are just fed up with it. And again, when you see the case of this guy tonight, he went to federal prison for mailing orchids, and he was raided by federal agents in riot or raid gear. It's just absolutely absurd. So you're listening on your computer or your cell phone, whichever you want to do. During the new segment of the show, you can call in at 347-996-5983. That's 347-996-5983, if you wish. 5 people could actually call in at one time, and we could talk. But anyway, we're nearing the end of the summer, so we're going to kind of slip out of the recorded sessions for a while and bring on some guests that I think you will enjoy. I've got a couple lined up, and I'll release them here in the next their names here in the next several weeks and what they do inside the criminal justice field. Well, Audrey, you have your blonde joke for tonight? Oh, that's right. It's a series of blonde jokes. Audrey's got some one-liners tonight, but they're really good. She gave me a preview look at these, and every now and then we let her do her one-liners. But Audrey, in case you don't know, Audrey is a blonde. She grew up in London, England. She's been a collector of blonde jokes. She is not offended by them whatsoever. In fact, she thinks it's funny, and I am sure that she has the world's largest collection of blonde jokes. Audrey, let's go ahead with what you got tonight.
Professor Haley, the blonde joke for tonight is actually another series of short question and answer jokes. Some are really funny. I had to look hard for these good ones. Here they are. How can you tell if a blonde is a good cook? She gets the Pop-Tart out of the toaster in one piece. What do you call a blonde at university? A visitor. Why does a blonde smile in lightning storm? They think they're getting their picture taken. Why did the blonde only smell good on the right side? He didn't know where to buy left guard. Why did the blonde put her finger over the nail she was hammering? The noise gave her a headache. Did you hear about the blonde who couldn't wait to see 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea? He said that he loved baseball, and was surprised that there were so many teams. Why did the blonde stand in front of a mirror with his eyes closed? He wanted to see what he looked like asleep. How many blondes does it take to make a circuit? Two want to stand in the bathtub, and another to pass him the blow dryer. What happened to the blonde ice hockey team? They drowned in spring training.
All right, there's some good ones. The hockey team drowned in spring training. All right. Thank you very much, Audrey, for that. And ladies and gentlemen, on a much more serious note, as we always say, and it will relate to a new story we have tonight, the Ohio Coalition Against Firearms has a public service announcement that they would like you to hear. This is directed toward not you, but the criminals. And this is the criminals, they think, if they hear this public service announcement, they will take their guns and get out and turn them into the police department and have them destroyed. Ohio Coalition, go ahead.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. Message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
Well, thank you very much, Ohio Coalition, and it certainly is, and we know that many gangbangers, street criminals carry firearms, and they shouldn't do that. Well, ladies and gentlemen, in the interest of planet sustainability and saving the planet, I'm not even going to comment tonight in the news about the gentleman that took hostages and was finally killed at the Discovery TV channel's headquarters in Maryland, in Montgomery County, Maryland, Silver Springs, Maryland. Strange character, strange motives, odd ideas. I guess overall he was standing for something like we should stop perpetuating parasitic human beings. In other words, if we have fewer people on the planet, we're going to have less global warming. We'll be able to sustain the planet. There is one last, and one of the things I admired about that case, I said I'm not going to talk about it, is I liked the chief of police and coming out and talking himself about this case. Did you notice that? Did folks see that? He didn't send out a public relations person or lower-level person. He came out and talked himself. You know what the requirement is, prime requirement is to be a public relations officer for a police department or any organization, right? Is to smile, talk, and say nothing. Well, the chief came out and gave us real solid facts based on what he knew, and I was very impressed with that. You used to see that more and more years ago, and then we went this public relations officer route, and chiefs and sheriffs very seldom appear, at least appear much less than they used to. Well, the green tip tonight, we won't have much more time to deal with this, but probably even tonight there are people out there, perhaps after work, that were mowing their grass. And, you know, mowing the grass is relates to planet sustainability. And one of the things you can do is you can mow your grass too often. And Esma Floyd's book, 1001, Little Ways to Save the Planet, I'm going to actually combine about three different tips on grass mowing. And I hope this falls on the correct ears and people understand what to do, because this global warming is a serious business. Would you pass me some more water, Emily? Thank you very much. It's heating up. All right, growing your grass. Allow your grass to grow high to at least an inch and a half before you cut it, or the grass will be weakened because the roots won't get a chance to deepen into the soil if the top of the grass is continually being cut. You know, there are people that just cut their grass continuously. You know, it's up a quarter of an inch or an eighth of an inch, let's run the mower over. Or they do it regularly whether the grass is grown or not. Let the clippings lie. Leave your clippings after mowing the lawn rather than collecting them with a mower, bag, or raking it away, as this will help feed and replenish the soil. That's a good idea. And then tinkle your sprinkle. That's Esma Floyd's third little tip. Sprinkler systems in your yard aren't good. They use so much water. They use as much water as a family of four would use in a whole day just watering your lawn. So what Esma Floyd is recommending is to get yourself a water can and walk up and down your yard with your water can and very carefully water your grass. I don't recall Mike, have you ever seen anyone do that? I haven't either. That's as an employee, these are all fact checked, and I'm sure she's correct in terms of doing that. So there you are. Let your clippings lie, tinkle your sprinkle, and let your grass grow a little bit, and you'll help save this planet. Okay. Let's take a look at some of the criminal justice news. Interesting stuff here. I have a lot of other things to deal with tonight, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on news, but some of these issues are really good. You know, our federal prison system is a very interesting place. I remember once when I lived in Texas that the warden in Fort Worth, he said that he wanted his prison to look as much like a college campus as it could. He didn't want it to have any of the trappings of a prison. That's kind of an interesting idea, isn't it? We go to prison for what? A number of reasons. We want people to be deterred. We certainly want to incapacitate them. We want others to see that if you do those crimes, you can go to prison. And then retribution, I guess, is the idea that you're getting what you deserve. But it's kind of like a college campus. I'm not exactly sure that that turns out to be, in the broadest sense, or the narrowest sense, punishment. But anyway, federal prisoners are failing to notify crime victims and witnesses when inmates are allowed to travel by themselves for medical treatment, according to the Justice Department Inspector General today. They released this information. The Federal Bureau of Prisons expects it will take until 2017 to require the notifications because it will take that long to negotiate the matter with the union that represents federal corrections officers, according to Inspector General Glenn Fine. The time frame is excessive and unacceptable, Fine says. The Bureau of Prisons proposed a revised furlough policy in 2003, but it has been yet to be negotiated with the American Federation of Government Employees, National Council of Prison Locals, Fine's report said. Can you imagine this? They wanted to change this in 2003. Another great job by the federal government, right? The agreement between the union and agency specifies how policy proposals are negotiated, including that they generally are handled in the order received, the report said. It noted that 50 policies are awaiting negotiation. More than 18,000 inmates over 3 years have been given permission to leave federal prisons unescorted to go get medical treatment. The report says that 6 inmates escaped rather than returned to prison. Now, if it's a typical federal agency type of response or accounting, maybe it's 600 have, but they haven't figured out that their cells are empty or their rooms are empty as of late. But isn't that absolutely incredible? I mean, we can't even institute a policy of stopping people going out and, notifying witnesses and former victims of these criminals, but these characters are out running around by themselves getting medical treatment. I'm astounded. Detroit had a gun buyback, and it's worked out pretty well. This is dated September 2nd, the Detroit News. It says the police department's run out of cash for today's gun buyback program, but it's issuing vouchers that will allow people to receive payment within 30 days. Isn't that something? Officials began exchanging cash for guns at 10 a.m. today, and by 1 p.m., they had received 400 guns and paid out more than $20,000, according to Police Sergeant Erin Steffen. It's great, she said. We're very happy. We see citizens are stepping up. They're realizing that they can be part of the solution. I'm trying to think exactly how that's part of the solution, but the idea is that we get more guns off the street, then criminals won't have the guns, and I suppose all the people turning in the guns were criminals, right? Or were they people finding rusted out whatever in their garage or in a trunk in their home and coming down and turning over the gun? Here's how it works. The police will pay $25 for a gun that doesn't work. They'll pay $50 for a gun that does work and up to $100 for 2 or more guns. And cash was handed out until vouchers had to be used. Isn't that incredible, Stephen said. Continental Management donated the money for the program, which is the department's first of the year. We have to get our guns out of circulation, says Interim Detroit Police Chief Ralph, Godby, Jr. He said, we don't know for sure what these guns would be used for,
but we know they won't be used for crimes now. He says black men ages 15 to 24 years old make up only 7% of the city's population, but account for more than 25% of all the homicides in the city. And I wonder, they don't give us any demographics on the people that turned in their guns. Do you think it was that demographic that actually came in? Now they're putting together a new coalition program where they're going to work with churches and other faith-based groups to have gun turn-in programs also. So get those guns off the street, and if law-abiding citizens turn all those in, do you think the criminals are, you know, I was going to rob a bank tomorrow or a convenience store, but I can get $100 for this gun if it's operable, or $50, and I'll go down and turn it in. Or could I wait and go rob the store and get $3,000 and turn the gun in the next day? I'm sure that kind of calculation doesn't go on. This is an interesting one. You know, what goes on behind prison walls? They used to call that the hands-off doctrine. We had a correctional administrator from the state of Ohio, Michael Randall. He resigned as director of the Illinois Department of Corrections yesterday, after months of criticism over a secret early release program of more than 1,700 inmates. Now, can you believe that? But didn't affect him. He's going to be the director of a new residential facility in Cleveland, part of the Oriana House program. He's going to work for them in a pre-release type program. It houses like 200 low-level violent offenders. So apparently he was letting people out of prison for what reason? I don't know. I remember we had a governor in Tennessee who was paroling people years ago in the 1980s, and he was doing it because they were giving him money. So I hope that's not the case with this particular gentleman. Well, speaking of street criminals and gangs and guns, this is kind of an interesting one. Street gangs, at least a number of them, and their leaders and former members, had a press conference in Chicago yesterday. And at the press conference, wait a minute, that was today. At the press conference, they complained that the Chicago police aren't treating them right. Superintendent Jody Weiss, that's a woman, police superintendent, she actually met secretly with gang leaders and warned them of serious consequences if their violence continues, and it is violent. In the last several days, and one afternoon and evening, four or five people, young people were shot. I mean, it's just terrible. But they're saying that she's treating them wrong. They would rather have jobs. You know, give me a trip to a bricklaying yard or something like that. And this gangs, drugs, and guns, it's not our fault, they're saying. And they're saying that the chief actually threatened them with RICO statutes. That's racketeer-influenced corrupt organization federal statute, where they'd be charged and get long federal sentences. Mayor Daley, he's always one to comment. He says, anyone who wants to speak out or complain has a right to do so. These are gang members. These are criminals that are running drug operations and shooting people. But again, it's America. They have the right, so they're having a press conference. Seems like maybe at the press conference there ought to be at least one or two that might have a warrant out for them. Chicago police thought of that? Maybe. Maybe not. But isn't that incredible that they're having a news conference and they're complaining that the police are being too rough with them? Isn't that incredible? And then they go through in the article and talk about the young men that were shot, a series of them in just like one day, in one evening. Isn't that terrible? I thought this was just a hoot. I mean, you almost have to laugh at this now. The federal government has now posted signs along a major interstate highway in Arizona. It runs about 100 miles north of the U.S.-Mexico border. I know exactly where they're talking about because I've been there. Warning travelers that the area is unsafe because of drug and alien smugglers, and the local sheriff says Mexican drug cartels now control some parts of the state of Arizona. These signs are posted on the Bureau of Land Management property along a 60-mile stretch of Interstate 8 between Casa Grande and Gila Bend, a major east-west corridor linking Tucson in Phoenix with San Diego. Again, I know exactly where they are. The Bureau of Land Management, by the way, is the one that has actually raised the broken-down three-strand barbed wire fence, which is our border security device down there in that area. they've raised the bottom strand so that the illegals and criminals who are crossing into the United States won't get hurt. They warn the travelers that they're entering an active drug and human smuggling area. Isn't this incredible? And that they may encounter armed criminals and smuggling vehicles traveling at high rates of speed on their way to Phoenix, which is less than 50 miles away from this particular location. Sheriff Paul Babeau, Pinal County Sheriff, whose county lies at the center of the major drug and alien smuggling routes to Mexico, he said his deputies are outmanned and outgunned by drug traffickers in the rough-hewn desert stretches of his own county. These drug cartels, they control parts of Arizona now. He said it's incredible. He wanted 3,000 National Guard troops, but the Obama administration sent him 15 signs, responded with 15 signs that this is a dangerous area. The article goes on, and Jan Brewer and my gosh, we now know that Sheriff Arpaia is being sued again by Eric Holder in the Justice Department for not responding promptly enough. He's only given over about 100,000 documents, they say, but they're saying he's not responding enough to an investigation to see whether he's being racially and ethnically discriminatory in his enforcement policies in his county. Maricopa County. Sheriff Joe, I think, will, I heard him on radio already this afternoon responding to this, and he said that, we're not going to give up on this, and we're going to keep doing what we think we're doing. And why should he be punished and picked out for enforcing the law? And what he says, he believes this is all directed toward Arizona, not him, and he just happens to be a target that holds his head up high. Now, in contrast, how many knew this? On the northern border of the United States, there are trains and buses that the Lakeshore Limited runs between Chicago and New York City without crossing the Canadian border. But when it stops at Amtrak stations in western New York State, armed Border Patrol agents routinely board the train, question passengers about their citizenship, and take away non-citizens who cannot produce satisfactory immigration papers. Are you a U.S. citizen? Agents asked one recent morning, moving through a Rochester-bound train full of dozing passengers at a station outside Buffalo. What country were you born in? When the answer comes back to the United States, they move on. But when Ruth Fernandez, age 60, a naturalized citizen born in Ecuador, was asked for identification, and though she was only traveling home to New York City from her sister's home in Ohio, she had made sure to carry her American passport. On earlier trips, she said agents had photographed her and had taken away a nervous Hispanic man because he didn't have ID. Now, we've got all this talk and problem going on down in southern Arizona all over the state of Arizona, and the government actually suing Arizona and the administration making fun of Arizona at a United Nations Human Rights annual meeting or biannual meeting, whatever it is. But we're actually asking people for their ID and their citizenship up on the northern border. So you tell me what's going on in that type of business, and maybe you can explain it because I can't. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's enough of the news tonight. We're gonna switch over here. We're gonna take a listen to this segment of John Stossel at first, talking about over-criminalization and going over three or four cases of people who have actually been arrested by these very vague, surprising federal laws. People arrested for crimes for doing things they had no idea were actual crimes. So give us a chance here to make the technological switch, and I think you'll really enjoy this segment. We won't be able to hear everything. We'll hear all of John Stossel in part of the second segment, but I'll give you the data where you can go listen to this yourself if you'd like to hear more. Hold on.
Are you prepared to join me? In here? In jail? You better get prepared because I'm going to keep passing new laws all the time. they passed so many, they've created a new crime just about every week. It's gotten to the point that it's hard to live a busy life without breaking some rule.
In Indiana, a student got in trouble because he read this book in public. This man went to jail because he sold orchids without the right paperwork.
And you better watch out if you dare practice capitalism.
This science team tried that. He was jailed for selling 1 pound of sodium on eBay.
I put myself in here because I figured it's just a matter of time before someone locked me up. It'll probably be the food police because, you know what? I like these cheeseburgers. And yes, they're high in fat and salt. Pretty soon these will be illegal. The rate the politicians are passing their new laws, new restrictions on freedom. Do you like orchids? This is a phalaenopsis. But did you ever sell one of these things? You did? Where'd you get it? You better have a permit, paperwork from the government that says your orchid was legally procured, or else you could go to jail.
In Spring, Texas, George and Kathy Norris cultivate orchids and bonsai trees. They used to run an orchid business out of this greenhouse. They import some and sell them. But then one day, they woke up to find their house surrounded by six men wearing black vests and carrying guns. It looked like a drug ring.
I assumed they were raiding the wrong house. So I went to the front door, and as I unlocked it, they pushed the door in, and the guy pinned me up against the wall with his forearm and said, "Don't move."
They were agents from the Fish and Wildlife Service. They quickly ransacked the Norris' home and greenhouse.
It looked kind of like a small tornado if you hit it. Stuff was literally dumped down on the floor. It was a mess. And I couldn't understand what they'd be looking for that involved dumping my underwear out on the floor.
They were looking for evidence that Norris sold endangered orchids. But they didn't find that. However, Norris had shipped some orchids without the required paperwork. They charged Norris with felony, as the Heritage Foundation tells it in this video.
We had spent over $100,000. Our savings were gone. She was going to be in a fix. The attorney said, maybe if you plead guilty, the judge will be lenient, and all you'll get is probation time.
But that's not what happened. George was sentenced to a year and a half in federal prison. And he joins us now from Houston with his wife, Kathy. So, a year and a half in jail?
Yeah, that's what it was.
Were you endangering species?
No, the plants that I was bringing in were perfectly legal.
And so you spent over a year in federal prison with robbers, murderers, I assume, and they say, what are you in for? Uh-huh. And you say, I'm in for selling this orchid. What do they say?
Yeah, it's a little embarrassing, but I admitted up to it.
Kathy, what did this do to you, to your life?
Well, for starters, I couldn't believe it happened. I grew up in a world where this wasn't how it was treated, and certainly not by the government.
I'm told we're a nation of laws, and these people are protecting law and order.
I didn't find it being enforcing law and order. I found it to be ludicrous.
Well, George and Kathy, thank you for joining us. And you at home may think that the Norris' case is unusual, isolated, but Brian Walsh says it is. He's the editor of this new Heritage Foundation book, One Nation Under Arrest.
The book explains that even if you mean to do nothing wrong, you may still go to jail for breaking one of the many new criminal laws that government keeps inventing. A 12-year-old girl was arrested for eating French fries on the subway. A suburban grandmother was arrested because her hedges were taller than 2 feet. A businessman was jailed for years because he imported lobster tails that were in the wrong package. The subtitle of the book is How Crazy Laws, Rogue Prosecutors, and Activist Judges Threaten Your Liberty.
So the Norris' orchid story is in the book, so let's start with that. How do you go to jail for best-selling orchids for a year and a half in America.
There's an astounding number, John, of vague, overbroad laws that don't require a person to have acted with criminal intent in order to end up in prison.
I can't see these prosecutors all as bad guys who just want to hurt good people.
Well, I think many of them are not. As it turns out, even if 99% of the prosecutors are good people and really being careful, it's only that 1% that you have to deal with, and that 1% can ruin your life. So I think in many instances they are actually motivated by good intentions, but the laws are so broad that they feel compelled many times to enforce them.
And you talk about 1%. Are we cherry-picking, picking a wild example here that is always an outlier?
There's many cases now, John, that we're receiving. In fact, through shows like yours, we're just starting to get the word out to most Americans. And yet, I still receive questions and inquiries every week via email and telephone about cases just like the Norris's.
We have another case from your book. Let's look at that. Christer Evertsen, an amateur scientist. He always has been a science geek. Here he is in high school and at the science fair in Idaho, where he still lives. Here's his proud mom. Anyway, a few years ago, he was trying to invent a new kind of fuel cell. To make it, he bought lots of sodium, and then he ran out of money, so he sold a few pounds of the sodium on eBay to college researchers. 2 months later, he was driving home when suddenly government agents in SUVs forced him off the road and surrounded his car. They're behind the door, they're aiming all these machine guns at me, and they're wearing black helmets with visors, can't see. Just black, everything's black, bulletproof vest, everything. And then that's where my nightmare started. He was arrested and threatened with jail for mailing 1 pound of sodium without the proper label. I said, what label? I told the FBI agent, I don't need a label. I asked him, what is the right way to pack it? And the FBI agent said, I don't know. But they took him to court where a jury acquitted him. So the government attacked again, this time charging him with abandoning hazardous material. There's a law called RCRA. I said, what's RCRA? Never heard of RCRA. The result? Well, the Heritage Foundation text speaks for itself. Months?
It's outrageous. It's a long period of time. He had all of his materials properly stored in stainless steel drums, 3/8 inch thick. There was no damage to the environment. If there had been any damage to the environment, he would have been charged with such crimes, but he never was.
The EPA got back to us finally today, and they say at his trial, the government proved he knowingly abandoned hazardous material, 60 drums of sodium, exposed to the element. If it had become wet, it could have exploded.
Well, first of all, those elements, they weren't open to the elements. If they had been, they would have charged them with that crime.
We have so many laws that people don't even know what they are.
That's true. As a matter of fact, both the Justice Department and the Congressional Research Service have been asked in many instances to tell us how many federal crimes there are. They couldn't even come up with the number.
And they keep passing more. Well, thank you, Brian Walsh. When we return, I'll tell you who's to blame for this assault on our freedom.
Good afternoon. Thank you for joining us here at the Heritage Foundation. As Director of Lectures and Seminars, it's my privilege to welcome you to our Lewis Lehrman Auditorium, and also the one to ask everyone in house to make sure you have your cell phones turned off as a courtesy to our presenters. Most of the time that does include the panelists as well, but some like to get last-minute messages, I know. We will post the program within 24 hours on the Heritage website for everyone's future reference as well. Hosting our discussion this afternoon is Robert Ault. Mr. Ault is our Senior Legal Fellow and Deputy Director of the Center for Legal and Judicial Studies. He has written and lectured extensively on issues of constitutional law with particular emphasis on civil rights law, election law, separation of powers, anti-terrorism, and the law of war. Prior to joining Heritage for a second time in 2008, Mr. Ault taught national security law, criminal law, and legislation at Case Western Reserve University School of Law in Cleveland. He first served here from 1997 to 1999 as deputy congressional liaison. a graduate of the University of Chicago Law School. He also clerked for Judge Alice Batchelder on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit. Please join me in welcoming my colleague, Robert Ault. Robert?
Thank you, John. I presume that my audience members did not have the misfortune of having suffered through my criminal law class. But if you had, you would have heard me, like criminal law professors throughout the nation, droning on about cases like N. Ray Winship and the requirement that prosecutors establish both the actus reus, or bad act of a crime, as well as the mens rea, or guilty mind. But judging by recent congressional action, my teaching methods, or at least the material, seems to have been a bit quaint. In a groundbreaking study, Without Intent, How Congress is Eroding Criminal Intent Requirements in Federal Law, the Heritage Foundation and the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers provide tangible evidence of how Congress is failing to provide adequate guilty mind requirements in statutes, making it possible for individuals to become criminals by mere accident or inadvertence. Worse still, they are passing these laws at a reckless pace. The state is important for two reasons. First, because it shines a light on a massive problem, the development of criminal law, a phenomenon rightly dubbed over-criminalization. And second, I would add, in an area in which it is frequently lamented that Washington is too fractious and partisan, the report is evidence of organizations generally characterized as from the right and the left working together to achieve a significant product addressing a serious national problem. We have a fine panel which we've comprised today to chat about the report and the problem of over-criminalization more generally. The first, I'm going to go ahead and do the introductions, short bias for each of the speakers, and then we'll simply allow them to go in turn. Our first speaker today is Norman Reamer. He is the Executive Director of the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. NACDL is the preeminent organization of the United States advancing the mission of the nation's criminal defense bar to ensure justice and due process for all and to advocate for rational and humane criminal justice policies. As executive director, Norman Reamer leads a professional staff based in Washington, D.C., serving NACDL's more than 11,000 direct members and 90 local, state, and international affiliate organizations with another 35,000 members. Prior to assuming this position, Norman practiced law for 28 years. To list the prominent cases that Norman has been involved in would take the full hour of our time, so I'll simply state, give you a little bit of a flavor. He has handled every kind of criminal law imaginable, from white-collar crime to street crime, labor law violations, Ponzi schemes, from petty larceny all the way to double infanticide. His organization co-authored this report, and he and the NACDL have been stalwart fighters against these excesses of over-criminalization and have partnered with the Heritage Foundation on this project as well as addressing other significant issues on Capitol Hill. Our second speaker is Brian Walsh. He is the Senior Legal Fellow in the Heritage Foundation Center for Legal and Judicial Studies, where he directs our project countering the abuse of criminal law and the criminal process, particularly at the federal level. His work was instrumental in spurring the first ever congressional hearing on overcriminalization in 2009. He is widely recognized for his leadership in developing a reformed coalition of individuals and organizations spanning the ideological spectrum, and National Public Radio called him one of the strongest voices calling for the end of overcriminalization at the national level. Walsh and his Heritage colleague and co-editor, Paul Rosenzweig, recently published the book One Nation Under Arrest, How Crazy Laws, Rogue Prosecutors and Activist Judges Threaten Your Liberty, and he is co-author of the report we are here to discuss today. The third panelist is Andrew Weissman. Mr. Weissman is a partner in Jenner & Block's New York office and co-chair of the firm's White Collar Criminal Defense and Counseling Practice. Mr. Weissman is a nationally recognized white-collar litigator, and in 2009 won the largest financial industry regulatory authority arbitration award in history, arising from the failure of the auction rate security market. Mr. Weissman joined Jenner & Block after serving as the director of the Enron Task Force. The Justice for the Eastern District of New York, Mr. Weissman supervised over 110 prosecutors, overseeing a wide array of white-collar crime investigations involving, among others, securities, FCPA, healthcare, environmental, computer fraud, and tax fraud. Our final speaker today will be Eric Brannan. Mr. Brannan is a partner with White & Case's Washington, D.C. office. His practice focuses on antitrust matters, including civil and criminal defense, as well as counseling for mergers and acquisitions and settlements of pharmaceutical patent litigation. He advises clients on the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act and the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. In 2010, Mr. Brannan was named one of the top 10 antitrust lawyers in the United States under the age of 40 and Law 360's Rising Legal Stars under 40. Previously, the Global Competition Review named him one of the top 25 competition experts from 10 jurisdictions to have passed through the revolving door between competition enforcement and private practice. Mr. Brannan returned to White & Case after serving as counsel to the Assistant Attorney General in charge of the Antitrust Division at the Department of Justice. He ended his DOJ service with a detail as a special assistant U.S. attorney in the District of Columbia.
Want to go to law school? Just kidding.
And after those introductions, which quite frankly didn't give the speakers sufficient credit, but nonetheless probably seemed like they took an eternity, I turn it over to Norman Toledo.
Thank you for the great introduction and for inviting me to participate in this panel with some real scholars, some really talented people. So I'm sort of an interloper on this because the real work was done by the authors, and you're going to hear more about that as we go through this. My role is really to set the stage for the discussion, put without intent into context. And to do that, I want to provide some insight as to how two groups that are not typically thought of as allies could come together on such an exhaustive research project. I came up with this phrase when we originally launched it, and it got some good play, and so now I've fallen in love with it, and I'll say it again. If you keep bending the arc of justice relentlessly toward injustice, left and right meet, and that's what's happening. After decades of overcriminalization and federal lawmaking run amok, it shouldn't come as any great surprise that NACDL and Heritage have common ground on this issue. NACDL, as Robert told you, is the Association of the Nation's Criminal Defense Bar. Our members believe passionately that when the government seeks to prosecute a person, and let's understand what that means. That means when the government seeks to strip a person of their freedom, of their liberty, and in some cases of their lives, no person, no matter how mighty or meek, should be without a vigorous defense and the protection of America's Constitution. Our institutional mission is to safeguard due process for all and to promote a rational, humane criminal justice system that is tied to the founding principles embodied in the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. In our daily work, and when I say our daily work, I don't mean NACDL's as an institution, but our members' daily work, in thousands of courtrooms across the country, we are the ultimate proponents of limited government. That's a fact. Now, I'm not well equipped to fully articulate Heritage's mission, but this much I do know. Among the first core principles which they championed is opposition to overcriminalization of conduct that is socially and economically beneficial and not inherently wrong. Their stated mission of pursuing limited government and traditional values in the context of criminal law enforcement is not at all dissimilar from what NACDL stands for and our mission to ensure due process. Thus it is that for the past several years, these two organizations have collaborated in a project designed to resist overcriminalization, uninformed lawmaking, and, in addition, the evisceration of the attorney-client privilege. Somewhat unwittingly, I would say, and wholly without regard to political affiliation or ideology, this nation has been legislating an intricate web of penal laws that are unhinged from the anchor of a clearly defined criminal intent requirement, the so-called mens rea requirement of a criminal statute. Our lawmaking process has become an instrument of social and regulatory engineering, which leaves the power to prosecute, the ultimate power of government, the power to destroy lives, in the hands, often in the hands of inexperienced prosecutors, unelected might add, who, regardless of their particular political ideology, with this kind of lawmaking, they are compelled to interpret and apply vague and artfully drafted provisions, thus guaranteeing inconsistency. And as somebody who practiced law for 28 years, I can tell you one thing. When it comes to enforcing criminal statutes, nothing so offends due process or is more unfair than inconsistency. How can anybody obey a law when even the most highly experienced and well-trained lawyers and judges can't agree on what the law means? They simply can't. But that's where we are today. We have over 4,500 criminal statutes, and we don't even know how many criminal provisions there are because many of these statutes empower regulatory agencies to create new criminal provisions, and the best estimate is something around 300,000 when you include all of these regulatory offenses. So for several years now, Heritage and NECDL have worked together to try to stop this mindless enactment of more criminal laws, especially when they're clearly not needed. Recently, we collaborated to oppose new criminal provisions in FERA, the Fraud Enforcement and Recovery Act, with some success, I might add. And we also successfully defeated a mandatory minimum in the health care legislation. But the root of the problem is how Congress makes the laws in the first place. And that's what Without Intent is about. It's a meticulous study of all the proposed criminal legislation in the 109th Congress, excluding guns, drugs, violence, and immigration. Still, without those, the plethora of legislation that affected those areas, it was a massive task. And even without those laws, the laws in those areas that were excluded, there were 446 offenses that were identified. What the study finds is that the core anchor of the American criminal justice system is lacking: the requirement of a guilty mind, the intent to knowingly break the law. The report proves that because of slipshod legislative drafting, 57% of the proposed laws lack an adequate mens rea or guilty mind component, thereby putting well-meaning people at risk of committing serious crimes without notice, without malicious intent, and without awareness that they were breaking the law. No one should harbor any illusions that this is limited to the 109th Congress. If it wasn't such a long, painstaking task, we'd have the 110th done, we'd be working on the 11th, and so on. The problem is that it is continuing, and it is continuing today. Just a couple of weeks ago, before the Senate passage of the financial services legislation, NECDL staff analyzed the provisions of the Senate bill and found numerous provisions that reflect a similar phenomenon. There's one, Section 202, which deals with the Orderly Liquidation Authority panel, that would impose criminal penalties for a reckless disclosure of a risk determination with no requirement of knowledge of the prohibition on disclosure, nor that the disclosure was done knowingly. Now, of course, we will have to sit through the final version that came out of the Senate and eventually whatever the final bill is, but the point is the problem hasn't been solved. In fact, among the remedies, which I know Brian is going to be addressing, there are two that merit some comment, and that is that there should be a minimally protective default intent requirement in all statutes, and secondly, that the judiciary committees of both houses should have some involvement in the process by which a criminal penalty is enacted. That did not happen with the financial services bill, and I doubt that it will happen in the weeks to come. So what we have to do, really, is return to the fundamental principles of fairness that are the hallmark of America's criminal justice system. We believe that if nothing else, Without Intent will raise awareness in Congress and the executive branch that the power to brand a person a criminal should be wielded with the utmost care and restraint and with protection for the innocent and the unwitting. And I will just conclude by noting that in the, what is it, just a couple of weeks now since the report has been released, thanks to some of the terrific professionals on my staff who have been following this, it has already been cited over 300 times in the media, everywhere from the San Diego Union-Tribune, the Cleveland Plain Dealer, the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, the Boston Globe, and on blogs from as varied a selection of places as Salon, Huffington, Free Republic, Washington Legal Foundation, and National Review. So I think it's safe to say that we have hit upon something here, that there is something wrong anything to do with whether you're a conservative or a liberal. It has to do with whether you are tethered to the concept of justice. And if you are, it's time for us to fix our law now.
Thanks, Norman. That's terrific. I have to say that mine's going to be a little bit more focused on some of the details, and I'm going to make mine short because I, compared to the professionals to my right and my left, my criminal justice practitioner experience is very limited. Most of what I did is a civil litigator, so they'll be able to tell you some of the details and answer questions about what happened in the trenches in the ways that I won't. But I want to start just by thanking the people who made this report possible. Of course, I want to start with my colleagues at the Heritage Foundation, and that's our chairman, Ed Meese, and Todd Gaziano and Robert Alt from our center, who this is really an unprecedented study, and it took on a methodology that had never been attempted before. And because of it, it was really quite a heavy lift. And without their insight, guidance, and direction, their analysis, their criticism, there's no way that this would have been able to be a successful project as it was. And I know that Robert Alt in particular spent innumerable hours helping make sure that the analysis and the conclusions that we were coming to were well-founded and reasonable. And I think that we've been successful. I've been very successful on that. And without his assistance, this would not have been possible. But I also want to thank our friends at NACDL, with whom we've been integral partners throughout this this process. I especially want to thank Norman Reamer, Shannon Regan, Ivan Dominguez, and my co-author, Tiffany Jocelyn. We were all convinced that this is a much-needed project, a much-needed study. But Norman was adamant that the report is not only much-needed, but it's important in the battle against overcriminalization. And it was worth going the extra mile to make sure that it was presented in a way that would be very compelling. And I want to thank him for his leadership on that. Shannon Regan, Tiffany Jocelyn, and I were in almost constant collaboration for months. And we had a debate, decide how to analyze and categorize 446 criminal offenses in 200 separate bills in the 109th Congress. And I have to say that my co-author, Tiffany Jocelyn, is a tireless young lawyer with, I'll say, an unlimited supply of energy to argue her views. And if she ever decides to be a criminal defense lawyer, I am confident that she will make many prosecutors earn their salary. So thank you, Tiffany, for all of your good work on this and your co-authorship. Thanks for the rewarding partnership and the successful study and report. And I want to say that this has been, you know, just part of it, the many things that we've done as a coalition and in collaboration with NACDL to help raise awareness of overcriminalization and begin to roll back the tide on it. Just for a moment, I just want to talk about the motivating purpose for this study. One of the main reasons that we undertook it was that there were people we found who were...
Well, I underestimated the time we're going to need. I wanted you to hear Brian Walsh, and he was interviewed by John Stossel there a little bit in that introductory clip, but he probably had, since he's the author of the book, or at least the co-author of that book, he probably had the most interesting things to say there. Might play a little clip of that next week. I'll think about it, whether or not, but this is serious business. You heard him talk about now, not only does the Congress pass these laws with general or lack of specific criminal intent, but now the regulatory agencies are being given lawmaking power. They always have had that, and they don't have any intent in what they're doing either. So you can do absolutely nothing, like, you know, growing orchids and sending them away in a package, and you end up with the cops making a raid on your home and your business. So anyway, it's an interesting kind of idea. And I want to thank you very much for listening tonight, and why don't you check the billing for next week and see what we're going to do. We might continue this. It's early September. We'll see what happens. But until then, I'm sure we'll be meeting again.
We meet again. Don't know where. Don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. He's smiling through, just like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. folks that I know, tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing this song. We meet again, don't know when, don't know where.